the vehicle won't be able to propel itself. When you place a giant metal screw on top of a paved road, the contact area between the screw and the road is incapable of producing enough friction. The design relies on the screws being able to sink somewhat into the ground and grip onto it. The last bit of hilariously bad design of a military vehicle is the Tsar tank. It was designed to look like a penny-farthing bicycle, the one with the giant front wheel, except the engineers felt that one giant wheel was not enough. The Tsar tank has two giant front wheels, about 27 feet high, and a single rear wheel. In principle, this design could be very intimidating, but like the Imperial Walkers, it failed in practicality. In order to keep the tank balanced, the rear wheel needed to support a lot of its weight, which meant that it sank into mud quite easily. Shields. Sanitation? Then how do you know how to disable the shields? Han Solo, Episode 7. When? Episode 6, Battle of Endor. Where? Endor. Characters: Han Solo, Princess Leia Organa. Physics concepts: energy. Short introduction background. Shields date back to prehistory, so it's safe to say that they are some of the oldest technology that we have. There is quite a difference between the wooden shields of our ancestors and the energy shields depicted in the Star Wars films, but the principle remains the same. There is some sort of threat that needs to be redirected or absorbed. How do energy shields work? Would shields like this be visible? Are permeable shields like the Gungans have, or impermeable shields like the ones on Scarif, more realistic? Have we ever created energy shields? Backstory. The primary defensive technology shown on the Star Wars galaxy is the energy shield. These range from small shields that protect Droidekas or Gungans to much larger shields that protect Star Destroyers, the Death Star, or even a Starkiller base. Some seem to just absorb blaster bolts, while others are deflective and cause shots taken at them to rebound into space. In almost all the Star Wars films, a shield features heavily in the plot, yet very few design details are ever disclosed. What do we know about the shields that protected the Gungans, made the Empire send AT-ATs to Hoth, and forced Han to pull off a daring jump out of hyperspace near Starkiller? The physics of Star Wars. Since there are so many different shields featured in the Star Wars saga, let's discuss their general properties before going into the specific variations. Again, shields in Star Wars either deflect or absorb blasters, perhaps with some form of electromagnetic energy that isn't always visible. They also all seem to have some maximum amount of damage they can take before going down. Let's look at the Gungan shields, deflector shields on ships, and the shields for Starkiller Base. The Gungan shield, which we first see in The Phantom Menace, is the most intriguing to me. The shields are impervious to projectiles launched from artillery, whereas droids seem to be able to walk right through them. The shield was most likely designed to have this strange property because it appears the Gungan weapons are better against infantry than against mechanical artillery. Their own artillery's range is completely inside the protective layer of the shield, so it does not offer them the same disadvantage. This shield is thus able to provide a protective barrier for their infantry to take on other infantry, while opposing artillery is unable to affect the outcome of the battle. Another interesting property of the Gungan shield is that it seems to be a bit elastic. Ripples will move through it when it is hit with artillery fire or a droid passes through it. In order to have ripples in a surface like that, it needs to have some form of surface tension. To my knowledge, there is no form of electromagnetic surface tension. The Gungan shield could work if it were a big dome of a sheer thickening fluid, non-Newtonian. What this means is that when you apply a force to the fluid, it becomes more viscous relative to the amount of force you apply. The most common example of this is the mixture of cornstarch and water. Ketchup has the opposite property. It becomes thinner with shear, which is why you have to hit the neck of the bottle in order to get the ketchup out. If the Gungan shield is a shear thickening fluid, then high-velocity projectiles would be stopped by it because of the excessive force they would exert on the shield. A droid walking through the shield would apply a much smaller force and therefore could pass through it without issue. Ships from X-Wings to Star Destroyers all seem to have deflector shields protecting them. These shields are different from the Gungan shields in a number of ways. First of all, they are invisible to the naked eye. Also, they seem to cause the blaster bolt to explode close enough to the ship to still cause some form of response. It seems as if the shields are as strong as the power source you provide them. Larger ships have more powerful shields, presumably because they are able to generate more power. If you are a smaller ship trying to run away from a larger ship, you can divert all the power to the rear shields. If you can stay in front of the enemy, then you do not have to shield any other part of your ship. Once the shield has failed, though, all shots that hit will do damage to the ship. Finally, there's the shield protecting Starkiller Base. It is said to have a fractional refresh rate, which prevents anything traveling slower than light from making it through. Although it is unclear precisely what this means, one possibility is that the First Order has decided to power their shields with AC power, outlet, rather than DC power, batteries. DC power provides a constant voltage and constant current. AC power oscillates from positive voltage to negative voltage. This means that for a fraction of a second, there is zero current and potentially no shields. Most places on Earth use AC power in wall outlets, and there is a division of opinion over what the frequency should be. Very roughly, if you are in the Western Hemisphere or Japan, the Koreas, or Taiwan, your power runs at a frequency of 60 Hz, whereas everywhere else runs at 50 Hz. For most purposes, including for the Starkiller Base shield design engineers, this on-off oscillation has no noticeable effect on anything. But if the shields were indeed oscillating with a frequency of, say, 50 Hz, then it would potentially be possible for a ship to fly through the shields while they are momentarily off. This poses an interesting physics problem. There is a tiny fraction of a second that the shields will be effectively off. The Millennium Falcon must completely pass through the shield during this interval. If we know the length of the Millennium Falcon and how fast it's going, we can figure out how long the shields are effectively off. The Falcon has a few advantages, though. As you move faster and faster, according to the theory of relativity, the length of your ship will be shorter, something called length contraction. If we assume that the rebels were rounding when they said the ship had to be going light speed, and instead the Falcon only had to go 0.999 times the speed of light, 0.999c, then the ship would be about 20 times shorter than its length when stationary. For something traveling at 0.999c, it would take about 5 nanoseconds for the Falcon to travel the necessary 1.5 meters. By this math, that means the shield can be penetrated by a ship as long as its strength is less than 10 to the power of negative 7 of its full strength. The physics of real life. As anybody who has watched a documentary about warfare probably is aware, we do not currently have giant blue shields that can surround our troops to prevent them from being hit. Kevlar is our low-tech equivalent of shields. But what is our current closest equivalent to the electromagnetic shields in Star Wars? The best that we have at this stage is a Faraday cage, discussed in the Electrostaff section. What about that bit with the Millennium Falcon using length contraction to slip through the shields? Is that really possible? The ideas introduced by the theory of relativity can be a bit complicated and mind-bending, but just about every experiment ever designed to test relativity has shown that this is indeed how the world works. The fundamental idea is that the speed of light is a constant whether you are sitting still or moving. At face value, this seems easy enough to accept. But the implications of it are a bit strange. If you throw a ball 100 miles per hour while standing next to a tree, the ball will move away from the tree at 100 miles per hour. If you get in a car and drive 100 miles per hour, and at the moment you pass the tree, you throw the ball 100 miles per hour in the direction the car is moving, the ball will move away from that tree at 200 miles per hour. This seems straightforward enough, but it is not the case with light. If you stand next to that tree and turn on a light, it moves away from the tree at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second. If you get in a car and turn on the light as you pass the tree, the light doesn't move at the speed of light plus 100 miles per hour. It still goes at the speed of light. When you are moving, and this is the weird bit, time slows down and distances contract. Suppose you measure a truck that is standing still and find it to be 16.4 feet long. If that truck now drives by you at 100 miles per hour and you measure its length, you will find it has shrunk to 16.39999999999998 feet. Obviously, it would be absurd to worry about such small differences in day-to-day instances. But imagine the truck drove by you at 80% of the speed of light. Now it would be 9.84 feet long. A considerable difference. This may seem strange, but it gets a little bit stranger. While you, standing at a fixed point, measure the truck to be 9.84 feet long, as it is traveling 80% of the speed of light past you, your friend driving the truck performs the same measurement and finds that the truck is 16.4 feet. But this truck is a physical object. So shouldn't it have a definite length? Shouldn't physics be consistent? The trick is that in order to measure the length of something, you have to do two things. You have to mark where the front of the vehicle is, and then at some time later, you have to mark where the back of the truck is. When it is sitting still, this is very easy. You just pull out your measuring tape and walk from the front to the back. When the truck is moving at 80% of the speed of light, the fact that the two events take place at different times is important, because time flows differently for your friend inside the truck compared to your stationary self outside of the truck. Even if you both mark the position of the front of the truck simultaneously, the moment each of you mark the location of the back of the truck will be at different times. This is what leads to the disagreement on the measurement of the truck. For those of you wondering, the actual length of the truck is 16.4 feet. In physics, we call the stationary length measurement the proper length. The force. The force, when all films, where the galaxy. Characters, all. Physics concepts, force. Short introduction background. The force is central to everything in the Star Wars universe, yet it is mysterious. Characters with a high midichlorian, sentient microscopic organisms count are described as being force-sensitive. In rare occurrences, the force itself can apparently conceive a child. How could an intelligent, microscopic life form allow a person to have magical brain powers? Can microscopic organisms have macroscopic effects on creatures? Is there actually a field that surrounds and penetrates all beings? Is the force a specific incarnation of one of the four fundamental forces of the universe? Can it manifest as any one of the four? Or is it a fifth force entirely? Electromagnetic force. Most interactions that we see on a day-to-day basis are electromagnetic interactions. Forces come in one of four varieties, as far as we know: gravity, electromagnetic, strong nuclear, and weak nuclear. The two nuclear forces only act on subatomic scales, so we do not experience them firsthand. Gravity is mostly only noticeable on very large scales. The force that your fingers exert on the book you are holding is created by the electrons in your fingers repelling the electrons in the book. The fact that you are not falling through the floor right now is because the electrons in the floor are repelling the electrons in your feet. Backstory. The force has been described on several occasions throughout the films. The first comes from Obi-Wan Kenobi in A New Hope when he says, "It's an energy field created by all living things. It surrounds us and penetrates us. It binds the galaxy together." Later we learn that there are microscopic organisms known as midichlorians, which act as a channel for the force to speak to Jedi. In The Phantom Menace, Qui-Gon Jinn says to Anakin, "Without the midichlorians, life could not exist, and we would have no knowledge of the Force. They continually speak to us, telling us the will of the Force." The Physics of Star Wars. The Force manifests itself in many ways throughout the films. Most of these occurrences make it appear that the Force is an electromagnetic force. For instance, your lightsaber doesn't know whether you used the Force to bring it to you or somebody came along, picked it up, and handed it to you. The lightsaber feels a force that causes it to accelerate to its destination. That is the way an electromagnetic force behaves. In physics, we say that two things can only interact via a force if they both interact with that specific type of field. For instance, only objects with mass can interact gravitationally. Only charged objects can interact electromagnetically. Since the Force permeates everything, it is likely that everything in the Star Wars universe can be affected by Force powers. The description that the Force surrounds everything could be another way to say that there is a field with which everything interacts. In theory, it would be possible for something to not interact with the Force and therefore be immune to its effects. For example, perhaps a Toydarian brain does not interact with the Force, thus rendering Jedi mind tricks ineffective on them. In our universe, dark matter does not interact electromagnetically. Since it does not interact with electromagnetism, it cannot produce or reflect any light, an electromagnetic wave, thus rendering it dark. Sensitivity to the Force could also allow a person to sense events in the distant past or in the future. Most laws in physics do not have a preferred direction of time, but as far as we know, there is no way to sense the future. There are theories that involve particles called tachyons, which can travel backward in time, but these have never been experimentally detected. Some descriptions of antimatter indicate that antimatter is just normal matter traveling backward in time. Perhaps the Force allows certain particles to travel through additional dimensions that connect different points in time. See hyperspace section for additional information on extra dimensions. Energy and gravity. Technically, two objects only have to have energy to interact gravitationally. This is due to Einstein's famous energy-mass equivalency, E equals mc squared. The physics of real life. As many of you are probably aware, there is no scientifically verified examples of magical brain powers. That's not from a lack of trying, though. Many people throughout history have claimed the ability to manipulate matter with their mind as well as be able to make predictions of the future through extrasensory perception. Perhaps one of the biggest names in this field of research is James Randi. He is a retired magician who had established the $1 million paranormal challenge. In this challenge, he promised $1 million to anybody who could pass a rigorous scientific test demonstrating paranormal abilities. It was terminated in 2015 after about 50 years of people failing to meet the scientific requirements of proof. One famous test involving Randi was known as Project Alpha. In 1979, James McDonnell of McDonnell Douglas set up a parapsychology lab headed up by physicist Peter Phillips. They decided to examine the phenomenon of spoon bending, the claim that people could bend spoons with their mind. James Randi was critical of the methodology used in the experiment and went as far as to hire people to stay within the protocols of the experiment, but to bend spoons not with their mind in a way that would generate a false positive. At the conclusion of the experiment, Phillips and his colleagues concluded that paranormal behavior could not be ruled out, at which point Randi revealed that he had gamed the system, thus discrediting the study. Let's examine those midichlorians. They are described as microscopic organisms that live in every cell and can communicate to Jedi the will of the Force. How possible is that? Well, more possible than you may think. Studies into the microbiome of humans, the collection of bacteria living symbiotically with us, has been growing in recent years. Estimates of the ratio between the number of bacteria cells in a human body and the number of human cells are astonishing. The numbers range between 1 to 1 and 100 to 1, meaning 100 bacteria cells for every human cell. A fact like this raises the question, what is a human organism? Is a human really a collection of many organisms in one? We have already discovered that our digestive system, in order to work effectively, relies heavily on gut bacteria. That's just with our stomach and guts. It couldn't affect our brain, right? Well, there are parasites that can take over animals and possibly have effects on humans. A dramatic and somewhat complex example of this is the Lancet liver fluke. It is a worm that lays its eggs in the intestines of cows. The eggs are excreted by the cows only to be consumed by snails. The eggs hatch in the snails, which then create cysts protecting themselves from the parasites and cough them up. The parasite balls are then consumed by ants. The parasites infiltrate the ants' brains and convince the ants that they should climb to the top of blades of grass near grazing animals, such as cows, thus completing the life cycle of the worms and completing the lives of the ants. If you were to talk to an ant at this time, it would tell you that it had a biological imperative to climb to the top of that blade of grass. Perhaps the ant calmed its mind and listened to the microorganisms talking inside of it. Although there are theories that similar parasites have effects on humans, more studies are needed before conclusions can be drawn. Forward or backward? According to the current laws of physics, it is impossible to distinguish between normal matter going forward in time from antimatter going backward in time in a mirror. Next time you look at yourself in a mirror, imagine that your image is made entirely of antimatter going backward in time. It's not. Physics would be incapable of determining the difference between actual you and bizarro you. Force Lightning. When, Episode 6, Battle with Emperor Palpatine. Where, Second Death Star. Characters, Emperor Palpatine, Darth Vader, Luke Skywalker. Physics Concepts, Electricity. Short Introduction Background. Lightning is a very powerful force of nature. It has dazzled humans for centuries. When Nikola Tesla created the Tesla coil at the end of the 19th century, he demonstrated the ability of humans to produce lightning and potentially harness its power. Like all scientific advancements, with great power comes great responsibility. Tesla coils are used for a few technical applications, but are primarily used for entertainment and education. If used inappropriately, though, a Tesla coil could be lethal. Would it be possible to channel lightning through a human in the way that a Sith does it? What are the consequences of being struck by lightning? What causes lightning in the first place? It is important to note that throughout this section, potentially lethal behaviors will be discussed. Do not try any of this at home. Backstory. In the climactic battle between Luke and Darth Vader, Emperor Palpatine steps in to finish the job. Vader watches as the Emperor repeatedly electrocutes Luke with lightning before stepping in and throwing his master into a reactor shaft of the Death Star. In this moment of redemption, we are able to see the power of Force lightning to both cause harm and make visible the skeleton of the person being hit. We also see the negative effects, sagging of the skin, teeth and fingers turning yellow, etc., that Force Lightning has on then-Chancellor Palpatine as he fights Mace Windu with Force Lightning. This Sith power demonstrates a powerfully destructive weapon. The Physics of Star Wars. When the Emperor first electrocutes Luke, he does it from about 10 feet away. Assuming that the gas in the throne room is similar to that of air on Earth, the voltage needed to generate such an arc would be about 9 million volts, or about 6 million AA batteries, enough to fill about 2 freight containers. This is an immense amount of voltage to be generated, more even than U.S. power lines. It should be clear that this voltage is too high for a normal person to channel. One potentially problematic aspect of the depiction of the Force lightning in this scene is that lightning is both lazy and always in need of a place to go. The room appears to be made out of metal, which, as a great conductor, would likely attract the lightning to it before it could go all the way to Luke. If we assume that the floor is somehow not a conductor, then the Force lightning depicted here would be essentially a beam of electrons. Those electrons, unable to flow to the floor, would build up in Luke's body, possibly causing damage to his DNA. In the battle between Mace Windu and Emperor Palpatine, Windu is able to deflect the Force lightning back onto Palpatine, causing severe disfiguration. The disfiguration mostly takes the form of wrinkles, as if he just aged a few hundred years. This is not the typical consequence of being struck by lightning. When lightning strikes a person, it can cause internal and external burns and possibly death. The primary cause of lightning-related death is an electrical current flowing across the heart. The heart is directed by a small electrical impulse generated by the sinoatrial node. When large currents flow across the heart, this can disrupt or destroy the sinoatrial node, leading to death in most cases. Damage to the skin typically takes the form of burns or scarring, not wrinkles. The lightning is always depicted emerging from the fingertips of the Sith. This is probably accurate. When it comes to lightning, it mostly connects with sharp, pointy things rather than flat things. This is because charge in a conductor will try to space itself out as much as possible. You might think, isn't a narrow finger going to have a bunch of charge bunched up? You'd be partially right. Yes, that charge will be confined to the finger, but it will be able to move away from the large amounts of charge in the rest of the body. When Darth Vader picks up the Emperor, we see flashes of Darth Vader's skeleton through his suit. This may appear to be cinematic exaggeration, and it is. But there is a way in which this would be possible. High-energy electrons, like those in a lightning bolt that strike a metal target like Darth Vader's suit, can give off X-rays. X-rays are used to image the skeleton. Before you get your hopes up about this, the only reason the results of radiography are visible is that those X-rays shoot through the body, and on the other side, there is film sensitive to X-rays. Some of the film receives exposure and some doesn't. Since calcium is a good absorber of X-rays, bones don't let X-rays through. perhaps Darth Vader's suit, is made out of photographic film? I suspect not. Lastly, the electricity created by the Emperor while electrocuting Luke appears to be a very low-frequency AC current. When a person is electrified, the current flows through the muscles, causing them to contract. When someone is electrocuted with direct current, DC, the muscles tense up and cannot relax. When a person is electrocuted with alternating current, AC, the victim spasms at about the same frequency as the current. As Luke is electrocuted, he spasms back and forth at about a rate of once per second or 1 hertz. Typical AC currents in U.S. households alternate at 60 hertz. So the Force Lightning is comparatively low-frequency current. Lichtenberg scar. One type of scarring caused by large electrical discharges is known as a Lichtenberg scar. This looks like a scar in the shape of branching lightning. It is also possible to create Lichtenberg figures in glass and other materials, which look like lightning frozen in place. The physics of real life. Despite being exceptionally common, lightning and the mechanism by which it works are not fully understood. High-speed footage of lightning, if you have never seen it, put this book down and Google it now, shows that immediately before a lightning strike, leaders are sent out in many directions. These leaders are sections of charged air particles that move outward, looking for an easy path to the ground or other such place to discharge. When a leader from the cloud meets a leader emerging from the ground, or another cloud, etc., a connection is made and large amounts of electricity flow through the path connecting the initial source to the ground. The lightning bolt that we see is caused by the heating of the air to exceptionally high temperatures. During a lightning strike, the air close to the lightning is heated to temperatures around 36,000 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 3 times hotter than the sun. At that temperature, the air turns to plasma and radiates a whitish-blue color, hence the color of lightning. During a lightning strike, hundreds of thousands of volts are discharged through a bolt of current, which is around 20,000 amps. These numbers probably don't carry a lot of meaning to the average person other than they sound big. Let us consider the different effects on a human body caused by levels of current flowing through the body. Current, MA, effect. 1. Slight tingle. 10. Painful shock. 100. Death. This is enough current to disrupt the electrical signals in the sinoatrial node. It is not enough to stop your heart, but enough to disrupt it enough to send you into fibrillation. Without medical assistance, this will cause death. 1000. This is the current delivered by a defibrillator. This will cause your heart to stop, but your heart will restart itself and probably be okay. 2000. Death. This fries the sinoatrial node and your heart cannot beat anymore. 10,000. If a finger, for instance, experienced this much current, it would disintegrate before the current could make it through the rest of the body. Although this would lead to the loss of a finger and all the hazards associated with that, it would not instantly cause death. Given these facts, shouldn't a person be instantly vaporized by lightning? Well, no. The reports of 20,000 amps in lightning is assuming that it is traveling through air. If that same amount of voltage is applied to the body, less current will be produced because of the higher resistance of the body. Obviously, lightning can be lethal. But there are people who survive lightning strikes, some of whom seem to be mostly unharmed. One possible cause for this survival is what is known as the skin effect. This is a tendency for high-frequency current to mostly concentrate itself on the outermost layer of conductors. For humans, the outermost layer is the skin, and thus it is possible for lightning to only go through the skin of a person before reaching the ground. Although very painful, This dodges the vital organs, which, when damaged, is what causes death. Force jump. Impressive. Most impressive. Darth Vader, Episode 5. When? Episode 5, Luke and Vader duel. Where? Cloud City. Characters, Luke Skywalker, Darth Vader. Physics concepts, force, conservation of energy, tensile strength. Short introduction background. Force users have many special abilities, including force lightning, mind tricks, and telekinesis. But what if a Jedi used telekinesis on herself? It has been demonstrated on numerous occasions that Jedi can jump to great heights. How could a Jedi use the Force to make this happen? How much would a Jedi's jumping ability be augmented by the Force? Is there a limit to how high a Jedi can jump? Backstory. In the famous duel between Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader on Cloud City, there is a moment when Darth Vader knocks Luke into a carbonite freezing chamber. Just before Vader can activate the mechanism, Luke jumps 15 feet, according to the script, straight up and out of the chamber. This is the first demonstration of a Jedi using the ability now dubbed the Force Jump. The duel with the highest volume of Force jumps is Duel of the Fates in Episode 1 between Darth Maul, Qui-Gon Jinn, and Obi-Wan Kenobi in the Feed Power Generator. Each of the duelers uses force jumps to move from catwalk to catwalk. Obi-Wan uses a force jump of sorts to ultimately defeat Darth Maul. The physics of Star Wars. Let us first look at the case of Luke leaping out of the carbonite freezing chamber to the relative safety of the carbonite hoses. In order to leap 15 feet in normal Earth gravity, a person would need to leave the ground at about 21 miles per hour, a little bit slower than Usain Bolt runs. For Luke's muscles to accelerate him to this velocity in the span of, say, a tenth of a second, it would require a force of about 1,500 pounds, or a bit more than the force of the average soccer kick. Spread out over the area of his feet, this would cause a pressure of about 8.7 per square inch, the pressure at 20 feet underwater. Bones can survive pressures up to 22,000 psi, about twice the pressure at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. So a Jedi's bones should be able to survive this without issue. If we work under the assumption that midichlorians don't enhance the tensile strength of bone, then we can estimate a maximum height to which Jedi can jump. Using Earth's gravity and rough estimates for Luke's mass and the cross-sectional area of his feet, we find that Luke could jump about 17,400 miles, or about five times the radius of Earth. This clearly indicates that the breaking strength of bone is not the limiting factor of how high a Jedi can jump, and anyway, who says the force jump puts any of the force on the bones themselves? So what is the limiting factor? Most likely, G-forces. We often measure large accelerations as multiples of the acceleration due to gravity on Earth, sometimes referred to as 1G or G-force. The number familiar to all intro physics students, 32 feet per second squared. The average human will probably not pass out under a sustained force of 5G. This is what you experience on the most extreme roller coasters. Trained fighter pilots can sustain close to 9G acceleration. If we are generous and say that a Jedi can sustain a 10G acceleration, she could jump about 16 feet. Keeping the rough estimate that it takes a tenth of a second from the initiation of the jump to leaving the ground. If we give her half a second, the Jedi could jump a much more impressive 400 feet. The effects on the body from too many G-forces are, in order, grayout, tunnel vision, blackout, G-lock, loss of consciousness, and death. The hilarious implication of this is that A Jedi who hasn't had his full training may try to force jump a little too emphatically and black out. The physics of real life. The most athletically fit humans can leap 65 inches upward. This means they could, from a standstill, jump up and land flat-footed on the head of a 5'5" person. If we take this to be the current limit of human vertical jumping, what G-forces do those jumpers feel? They accelerate over a span of about half a second to reach a speed of about 18 feet per second, which corresponds to about a 1.2 G-force. It is unlikely that these athletes have any trouble with blacking out from jumping too high. How can trained fighter pilots sustain up to 9 G-forces? Does the U.S. Air Force specifically recruit people with a genetic disposition to being able to survive G-forces? Loosely speaking, blackouts occur when blood leaves the head and the brain is deoxygenated. To combat this, the Air Force has developed special suits with inflatable legs that can apply compression to the legs of the pilot to help hold the blood higher in the body. Also, pilots are trained to clench all of their muscles and breathe in very shallow, controlled breaths. If you want to waste an afternoon, you can watch videos on YouTube of pilots going through G-testing. How do we know these things? Did scientists strap people into chairs, attach those chairs to rockets, and then see what happens? Well, yes. From the 40s through the 60s, engineers were designing faster and faster planes that needed ejector seats in case of emergency. Most designs involved rocketing the pilot vertically out of the plane, which is already going at high speeds. This, along with the desire to launch people into space, got scientists thinking about how much is too much for a human to sustain. To test the limits of human acceleration, Colonel John Stapp was strapped into a chair on a long, straight track. On the back of the chair was a rocket engine. This engine accelerated the chair down the track and then was brought to a screeching halt. All of these tests were done so that we would know that it would be possible to send humans to space. At this time, humans can't perform telekinesis. But if we did, could we exert those forces on ourselves? You may say, sure, why not? It's a magic brain power, so anything is possible. But let's consider a slightly related ability. You can use your arms to lift this book, and presumably you can lift heavier objects. Can you pick yourself up? The problem with trying to do that is that the force your arms can apply on an object relies on your feet interacting with the floor. For our bodies to exert forces on external objects, there must be an equal and opposite force reaction. So if the brain were able to exert a force on a block across the room, by the laws of physics, the block would exert an equal and opposite force on the brain. By extension, using telekinesis to lift yourself would not be possible by the laws of physics, because it would require pushing off from another object. The Frozen Blaster Bolt. I'll show you the dark side. Kylo Ren, Episode 7. When, Episode 7, opening scenes. Where, Jakku. Characters, Kylo Ren, Poe Dameron. Physics concepts, Newton's first law, phase changes, plasma, light. Short introduction background. In the Star Wars universe, the blaster is the all-purpose weapon of choice. As Han Solo puts it, hokey religions and ancient weapons are no match for a good blaster at your side. Blasters look like guns you or I might be familiar with, but shoot glowing beams, conveniently color-coded to indicate your allegiances. There is some debate as to whether the beams fired by blasters are made of gas, plasma, or maybe just light. In any case, when a blaster shot is frozen in midair, there is an interesting physics problem to explore. Backstory. In the 7th installment of the Star Wars saga, Kylo Ren introduces a possible new application of the Force when he freezes a blaster bolt in space. Specifically, a bolt fired at him by the soon-to-be-captured rebel pilot Poe Dameron. We know that Force users can alter the movement of solid objects, for example, by levitating them. But do these capabilities apply to any substance a Sith or Jedi might encounter? Based off of Kylo's suspended bolt and his grandfather's deflected blaster shots before that, shots coming from Kylo's own father, it would appear so. How might this be possible? The physics of Star Wars. Anyone who has taken a physics class should remember that an object in motion tends to stay in motion unless acted upon by an external force. If there's one thing that we'd expect the Force to be able to do, it's to exert an external force on an object. So changing the motion of an object with the Force isn't anything new, but is a blaster bolt an object? What are blaster bolts anyway? Various sources claim they are laser beams or some sort of plasma. Plasma is a state of matter, like solid, liquid, or gas, that is reached when you heat a gas to such a high temperature that the electrons escape the forces of their nuclei and roam freely. So plasma is a highly charged soup of whatever substance you heated. It is generally accepted that plasma blasters in Star Wars are powered by Tibana gas. Since this doesn't exist in the real world, we can't just look up its properties, but we can calculate some properties using basic science and assuming they apply to fictional gases. If the bolt is made of very charged Tibana gas, Kylo would only need to exert a modest 38 Newton force, the same as lifting an 8 or 9 pound object. What if the blaster shoots lasers rather than plasma? Unlike plasma, light has no mass, and as with all massless things, moves at 671 million miles per hour. We can slow down light by sending it through different materials. How much its speed changes is measured by a quantity called the index of refraction, represented by the letter N. For example, in glass, N equals 1.5. Light moves at about 450 million miles per hour, but in diamond, N equals 2.4, it slows to about 280 million miles per hour. So if a Force user is capable of changing the index of refraction of a substance significantly, the Force could possibly slow a beam of light traveling through that substance. Either of these possibilities should mean big things for Force users. Starkiller Base shoots projectiles that appear to be bolts of plasma, just on a much, much larger scale. If size matters not, as Master Yoda says, Kylo should be able to stop these projectiles just as easily. In contrast, the Death Star is a laser weapon. So a Force user would have to change the index of refraction of a material to redirect or slow its beam. Carbonite, Tibana gas, and Han Solo. What do Tibana gas and Han Solo have in common? They are both safest to transport while frozen in carbonite. Tibana gas is a fictional element found in gas giants around the galaxy, but most famously on Bespin. The gas is very volatile, which makes it useful for weapons and hyperdrives. In a pinch, you can spray your father in the face with it as a diversion. Due to high demand, it is also very valuable. One can learn more about the properties of Tibana gas by learning more about the planet where it is mined, Bespin. Given that Bespin is 118,000 kilometers in diameter and has surface gravity that is 1.5 times that of Earth, one can estimate the density of Bespin as about 893 kilograms m cubed. For comparison, this is about the same density as diesel fuel, or 2/3 that of Jupiter. The Force to stop a blaster bolt. In order to estimate the force required to stop a blaster bolt, we have to make a few assumptions and use our knowledge of plasmas. For most elements, the density of the plasma phase is not significantly different from the density of the gas phase. Since a blaster compresses the gas while heating it to the plasma phase, we assume that the plasma in the blaster has been compressed to a density approximately equivalent to Bespin's density. The blaster bolt itself can be measured to be about two-thirds of Poe's height and have the diameter of the barrel of the blaster. This means the mass of the bolt is around 1.89 kilograms, or the weight of a textbook. Newton's second law tells us that a force is the change in momentum divided by the time it takes to stop the object. It takes Kylo Ren about half a second to stop the blaster, and in that half a second, it travels a bit over 5 meters. Plugging in the numbers, we can see it takes about 8 pounds of force to stop the blaster bolt. The physics of real life. Obviously, Tibana gas is fictional, so we're not going to experiment with it at any time, but we can do this with other materials. To scientists, manipulation of the motion of plasmas is commonplace. Perhaps the most famous example of this is at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. In the LHC, materials are accelerated to amazing speeds, within a fraction of a percent of the speed of light, and collided together to make what is known as quark-gluon plasma. In a typical plasma, the electrons and nuclei float around without sticking together. In a quark-gluon plasma, the matter itself melts into its most fundamental pieces. The typical design of such a plasma containment chamber is a ring of magnets which cause the plasma to flow in a circle. One specific example of such a device is a tokamak. Despite looking like the hulls of the Death Star, a tokamak is a device designed to contain a plasma in a toroidal shape, think donut, for the purposes of generating energy from the process of nuclear fusion. The joke about fusion power plants is that economically feasible fusion energy is always 50 years away, but recent developments in fusion technology have made it seem more promising. The MIT Plasma Science and Fusion Center announced in late 2015 that their modular tokamak design may be just what the field needs. Currently, the smallest tokamak devices are still large enough that a human can walk around inside. As such, it would be very hard to make a handheld blaster with current technology. But the size of fusion reactors is becoming smaller every year, so maybe we will finally have blaster technology in 50 years. What about the controlling light? It turns out we are exceptionally good at it, and only getting better. As far back as the Assyrians in the 7th century BC, we were making lenses to redirect light. Over the years, we have found new ways to manipulate light. Research groups have been able to slow down light to speeds around 50 feet per second, and in 2013, a group at the University of Darmstadt were able to stop light for about a minute. There are other implications about the possibility of a Jedi changing the index of refraction of the air. For instance, when you see a mirage of a puddle on a hot roadway, it is actually light from the atmosphere that is taking a slightly bent path to your eye. The hot roadway is able to heat the air directly above it, creating a small temperature gradient. Light prefers to move through hotter air because of its lower index of refraction. Thus, light from the atmosphere will look as if it has come from the road itself. This means that if a Jedi could manipulate the air between him and the enemy, he could create a mirage of his body at another location. Similarly, a strong enough gradient could actually redirect a laser beam in another direction, causing all laser shots to bend around the intended target. Jedi mind tricks.
"These aren't the droids you're looking for."
Obi-Wan Kenobi, Episode 4. When, Episode 4, Mos Eisley scene. Where, on the streets outside Mos Eisley Cantina. Characters: Obi-Wan Kenobi, Stormtrooper. Physics concepts: electromagnetism. Short introduction background. The Jedi mind trick is the force power that I wanted as a kid. As an adult, though, I recognize that ability to control people's thoughts is a terrifying prospect. It's a power that could lead to great improvements in the world or horrific destruction. It isn't possible for us to control a person's thoughts, is it? If we wanted to be able to control someone's thoughts, how would we go about that? Is it any easier to read a person's thoughts? Would it make sense that there are some people whose minds are too powerful for a Jedi mind trick? Backstory. On the dusty streets of Mos Eisley, a few stormtroopers stop Obi-Wan and Luke to inspect their droids. Obi-Wan, calm and cool as ever, explains to the stormtroopers that they have nothing to worry about and to move along. The stormtrooper complies and orders his men to move along. The Jedi mind trick is attempted a few other times with mixed success and consequences. Qui-Gon is unable to use the Jedi mind trick on Watto because apparently Toydarians cannot be affected by them. Later, Obi-Wan convinces Elon Sleaze-Bagano to give up Death Sticks, go home and rethink his life. In the grand scheme of things, it would have been way more convenient if Elon Sleaze-Bagano had been the one immune to the Jedi mind trick, and Watto had gone home to rethink his decision to not sell the parts needed to repair the hyperdrive core. The physics of Star Wars. We don't know much about how the mind works and how thoughts are processed in the brain. What we do know is that when the brain is active, neurons allow ions to move in and out. This motion of charged particles will change the voltage, essentially a measure of how much charge is on either side of a membrane in this context, across the membrane of the neuron. When one neuron fires, allows the ions to flow, it might trigger an avalanche of neurons firing. This means that if we could control which neurons fired inside a person's head, we could potentially control his thoughts. According to our current understanding of neuroscience, this is in principle possible. The brain is composed of about 100 billion neurons, each connected to about 10,000 other neurons. According to current theories of neuroscience, some pattern of neurons fires, and based on the pattern, our brain is able to determine what we are seeing. Dealing with numbers in the billions is going to be prohibitively difficult for this example, so we will pretend for a second that there are only 100 neurons, and they are each numbered 1 to 100. In this simplified model, we could say that the response in the brain when a person sees the droids he is looking for is characterized by neurons 1, 37, 55, and 98 firing. When the person does not see the droids he is looking for, neurons 2, 75, and 79 fire. This means that if a Jedi could prevent neurons 1, 37, 55, and 98 from firing while also causing 2, 75, and 79 to fire, then a Jedi could, in principle, control the person's thoughts. The Force can be used to move physical objects. Luke stacks rocks and lifts R2-D2. Yoda retrieves Luke's X-Wing from the Dagobah swamp. Kylo Ren is able to freeze a blaster bolt in space. In order to accomplish these feats, an electromagnetic force needs to be exerted on the objects being moved. Electromagnetic force could also be used to cause ions to move across the membrane of a neuron. Admittedly, lifting an X-Wing is significantly less difficult than the precision needed to move particular ions.